chapter 3. We finished sections A and B. So we're up to... We finished from verse 1 to verse 9, so we'll go on with section C, starting with verse 10, from Karma Kanda to Karma Yoga. Verse 10. And you see this little diagram I've done. If you haven't made a copy of it in your own books, I would suggest you do it, because it's very helpful for understanding the scheme of how things work as they're presented in these chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So, the last subject we discussed yesterday was which is better or which is more suitable for the conditioned soul, Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga or some other process which involves not acting. It may be a meditative process, it may be a philosophical process, but just some other type of yoga which doesn't involve acting or working. And we saw Krishna made it very clear indeed that in the case of Arjuna, of the two, Karma Yoga was much more suitable, because he'd be able to engage his body and his mind in ways which were natural to them, but engage them in activities which are spiritually uplifting. Whereas if he didn't engage his body and his mind, gross and subtle bodies, if he didn't engage them actively, then, because they're very strong, they would sooner or later drag him down. So this is a very important point to grasp in these first chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So, starting with verse 10, from 10 to 16, we're discussing a process of elevation beginning with Karma Kanda and coming up to the level of Karma Yoga in a very natural, organic type of way. Here's the what's your name? Madhava. That's that, right? Thanks. So it's a very organic, very natural process which Krishna is going to describe here in these seven verses. Going from the level of demigod worship and just following the Karmakandya section of the Vedas, up to the level of real Karma Yoga as a real spiritual activity. So verse 10 is important because Krishna is saying, he's basically explaining here what is the intention of the Lord as far as this material world is concerned. That the intention of the Lord when he created this material world was to provide facility for sacrifice. In other words, it's like this whole material realm is really a big field of sacrifice. There's so many things in this material world. And the idea is that they're meant to be used in sacrifice for the pleasure of Vishnu. Of course, you know, people have other ideas. Generally, the conditioned soul thinks that this world is a place for sense gratification. If people become a little more advanced, you can sit up here if you want, there's plenty of. If people become a little more advanced, then they may get the idea that this world is like a prison house, Durga. You know, there's one name for Durga, Rudrani. Rudrani means one who can make you cry forever. It's a very suitable name for Mother Durga. One who can make you cry forever. So some people think it's like that. It's a tough place, and it's a real struggle, and we're really, you know, being kept down like a prison house. But here Krishna in verse 10 is saying that in the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures, and that is Lord Vishnu, that he sent forth the population of the universe, he placed all the different species of life in the universe, and along with them, he supplied different items to be used in sacrifice. And then he blessed the people that you'll be very happy if you follow this program of sacrifice. And you'll get everything you need and you won't have to suffer. It'll be very good. And of course, in the end, you could go back to Godhead. So now, seeing we're starting off with Karmakandiya. So, Krishna now talks in verses 11 and 12 about demigod worship. That the demigods, on behalf of the Supreme Lord, they're in charge of all these different items of sacrifice within the universe. So if you approach the demigods nicely, they'll supply you. But if you don't approach the demigods, then Krishna says, Stena eva sa, then you're certainly a thief. So this is Karmakanda, obviously, demigod worship. Get the facilities you need in a pious way and carry on with your material existence. Verse 13 is very important in that this is one of the two verses in Bhagavad Gita which very clearly establish the concept of not just vegetarianism, but the need to take prasad only. Because Krishna is saying in verse 13 that the devotees are released from their sin because they eat food which has been offered in sacrifice. The people who just prepare food for their own enjoyment, they're eating sin. Now Krishna doesn't say here that people who prepare meat to eat, that they are eating only sin. But people who prepare any food just for themselves, not to be offered in sacrifice, just for themselves, they're eating sin. So this is a very important principle. Prabhupada, on a number of occasions, Prabhupada was asked about vegetarianism as such. And Prabhupada, on so many occasions, said, vegetarian, non-vegetarian, it doesn't really matter. But the point is to eat prasad. That is the point. Because even if you eat, you know, like first-class vegetarian food, prepared excellently out of very nice ingredients, you're still eating only sin. Maybe it's less, it is less than if you eat meat. But still, you're eating sin. And it means you'll stay in this material world. So this is the very essential principle which is there in Krishna consciousness. We only eat food which has been offered, only prasad. When Prabhupada was in South Africa in 1975, he did a program at the Durban City Hall. And at the end he asked for questions, and one man who was like a vegetarian campaigner, he was like fighting for vegetarianism. He asked Prabhupada, he would print different publications advocating vegetarianism. He wanted to get Prabhupada to make some statement for vegetarianism. Then he wanted to print it and say, here look, the big Swami says you must be a vegetarian. So he asked Prabhupada, isn't it better, something along the lines of, isn't it better to be a vegetarian than to be a meat eater? And Prabhupada, you know, there's a crowd of about 2,000 or 3,000 people. Prabhupada said, it's not important. Even the monkeys are vegetarian. And what good is it doing them? You know, an elephant is vegetarian, a cow is vegetarian. And what good is it doing them? Do you see any of those animals becoming spiritually advanced? No. So, but if you eat prasad, if you take prasad, then even an animal takes prasad and they become purified. In the next life they may get human form of life possibly. At least in the future they'll be able to engage in devotional service. So this is the principle. We only eat food which has been offered in sacrifice. And even when you look at it, milk is actually, you know, quite a number of vegetarians won't touch milk or milk products, because it's a fact that milk is the blood of a cow transformed. In fact, if any of you who have milked cows, you would know that if you over milk a cow, then you start getting blood. You start getting blood coming out of the udders, because the milk is actually blood transformed. So it's not that milk is a vegetable. It's an animal product, actually. So, but Krishna is so fond of milk and milk products. So this is a very important verse then, establishing the principle of sacrifice, the necessity of sacrifice as far as food is concerned. Then the second very important verse about eating is chapter 9, verse 25, Patra Pushpam Phalam Toyam, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Krishna, in that verse, he says what he will accept if it's offered in sacrifice. Not that you can just offer any food in sacrifice, but Krishna will only accept certain types of foods. So in verses 14 and 15, Krishna explains it's a certain sequence. A certain sequence which leads from Karma Kandya to Karma Yoga. So the sequence is that everyone needs grain, food grains. That is, grain is like the basic food. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada says that vegetables and fruit, they are like secondary, just as like embellishments. But the real food is anna, grain. So everyone needs food, and how do you get food? He says, from rain. And how do you get rain? You get rain through sacrifice. And how do you come up with the idea of sacrifice? The idea of sacrifice is there as part of the process of prescribed duty in Varnashram society, as described in the Vedas. So these regulated activities of sacrifice are prescribed in the Vedas. And where do the Vedas come from? The Supreme Personality of Godhead. And what is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? He's transcendence. So through this process of sacrifice, following the Karma Kandya section of the Vedas, and then recognizing that the Vedas are leading to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that the ultimate goal is the Supreme Lord, then one gradually gets elevated from Karma Kandya eventually to the level of yoga, or at least Karma Yoga. So Krishna says, consequently, the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. You know, the basic principle of sacrifice is that everything belongs to God. Nothing really belongs to us. So we should use things for His pleasure. But He's so kind that when we offer Him those things for His pleasure, then He also gives them back to us. So in this way, human society can function very nicely on the basis of sacrifice. And in verse 16, the last verse of this section, Krishna describes the alternative. If you don't do this, then you're simply living a life full of sin, and you're actually living in vain. You're wasting your time. So, that is from Karma Kanda to Karma Yoga, starting with demigod worship. So the idea is that a person who performs demigod worship, if the demigod worship is being done properly, then in all of the sacrifices, Vishnu is sort of offered, the sacrifice is offered to Vishnu first. And then once some offering has been made to Vishnu, then they carry on with the rest of the sacrifice to whichever demigod they're trying to approach. So if they do their demigod worship or their karmakandya activities properly, they'll see that whichever deity we're worshipping or performing sacrifice to, we always worship Vishnu in each case. So hopefully they'll get the idea that Vishnu is in a higher position, and then they'll actually take to worship of Vishnu and then come to the transcendental platform. So if they do that, then it's a progressive process. From Karma Kanda, you can actually be elevated to Karma Yoga. So next section is D, verses 17 to 32. That one should act in Nishkam Karma Yoga. That means act according to your duty, but with no attachment whatsoever, Nishkam. And you should act like that in order to set an example. So in verse 17, Krishna is describing a person who's already self-realized. He's already self-realized. He takes pleasure in self-realization. He's satisfied in the self, fully satiated. So Krishna is saying that for him there's no duty. Now, we just got through the first couple of sections of this chapter after verse 9. And Krishna was stressing that you must do your duty, because you have to engage this body in activities. You have to engage this mind. You can't just sit down and do nothing. But this applies to people who are still conditioned, who are still under the influence of the body and under the influence of their subtle body. But now, here in verse 17, and actually in quite a number of verses in this section D, Krishna is going to talk about a person who has already transcended the body. So for such a person does not have to perform Karma Yoga, because they're not going to be overwhelmed by the influence of their bodily nature. It's not going to happen. They've already transcended their bodies. So for such a person, Krishna is saying here in verse 17, there's no duty. Such a person, according to our scheme here, such a person would already be up here, or up here, or up here, depending on which particular direction he went in his practice of Karma Yoga. But the basic idea is that this is a liberated soul. So for the liberated souls, there are no duties in terms of their material bodies. They can actually engage in jnana yoga. Just sit down and meditate, or sit down and speculate without doing anything physically. And they won't fall down because they're liberated. They're free of the influence of their bodies. But, you know, while a person is not liberated, then they have to perform this Karma Yoga. So anyway, for a liberated soul, there's no duty. There's no need to perform Karma Yoga. But in verse 18, Krishna says that such a self-realized person, he has no need to discharge duties, but he has no reason to not discharge prescribed duties either. It's not that he should think that, well, I'm a liberated soul, so, like if it was Arjuna, that I've gone beyond my nature as a Kshatriya now, so I don't need to act as a Kshatriya. But the thing is that if he does act as a Kshatriya, that is not going to drag him down, back down to the bodily platform of bodily duties and accepting the psychology of a kshatriya. So there's no reason for him not to perform duties. So Krishna is now going to recommend this action. That, as we see in verse 20, that just, if nothing else, just for the sake of educating the people in general, perform your duties. Even if you're beyond the need to perform duties or karma yoga, you still go through the motions. Has everyone marked themselves present? So just for the sake of educating the people in general. Then verse 21, that's quite a well-known verse, describing the relationship between those who are advanced and those who are just like the common people. The common people will always follow people who are very advanced. So therefore, it's important for the people who are very advanced to set a good example for the people in general. Like, take Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, we understand, was certainly a liberated soul, absorbed in love of God, fully realized his eternal relationship with Krishna. So he could have done, say, what some of the six Goswamis did. He could have just gone and sat at Radhakund. Has everyone marked themselves present now? Yes? Okay. Why not? Okay, pass it back to the liturgy. So Prabhupada could have gone and sat at Radhakund and just chanted Hare Krishna. That's sort of like the Vaishnava version of this idea of renunciation with no duties and nothing like that at all. Just sit there and think of Krishna all day. But what sort of example would that have been for people like us? We would have thought that, oh yes, we should also go and sit at Radhakund and chant Hare Krishna. Which wouldn't have been a very good idea, and Srila Prabhupada didn't recommend it at all. I mean, it's nice to visit Radhakund from time to time, but to just go and sit there and just try and get into that program of bhaja. For us, people who are definitely on the conditioned level, it's not recommended. So what did Prabhupada do? Despite the fact that he was on that platform, and he could have easily done it, and it would have been very nice for him. Very, very nice. But still, at least externally, he, so to speak, came down. Of course, he didn't really come down, but externally, he came down and he accepted the position of a regular devotee, a regular preacher, following a regulated program, preaching, chanting his rounds, and following rules and regulations, teaching rules and regulations. So he did that to set an example as Acharya, to set an example for people like us. So then we would see that, oh yes, he's very advanced, so let us do what he's doing. So here Krishna's stressing this point, that even a liberated soul, at least if a liberated soul is interacting with people who are not liberated souls, then it's like an important duty for the liberated soul to act in a way that those who are on a lower level, that they can relate to and learn from. Otherwise, like in Bengal, you get so many sahajiyas and people who are like variations on the idea of sahajiya. Because, and they think that to be a devotee means that you must chant and cry. And you can also roll on the ground and do things like this. This is what it means to be a devotee. Because they see that all the people who are like the leaders of the devotee community or so-called devotee community, that's what they do. So their idea is that when you join the temple, then the first day you must practice your rolling on the ground. And you must practice your crying like that. One devotee who preaches in Bangladesh a lot was telling me that when they have Vaishnava festivals, in Bangladesh, then he was saying that it means that the Swami or whoever gets up and starts conducting the program, then he starts getting really worked up about Gaunditai and, you know, really fired up. Then he starts crying. And then you look at the audience and you see there's so many people in the audience crying and just sort of, because they think this is what you do. This is what it means to be a devotee. You must cry and roll around. I remember during Kartik 2 years ago, a whole group of Bengali village people came, like about 30 or 40. They came for the evening arati. And then kirtan was going on, everything was going on. Then suddenly the leader, he sort of gave a signal. And they all just crashed to the ground. This whole big party of them. And before we knew, there are people rolling this way and that way. And we had to jump over them, and it was practically chaos in the middle of the evening arati. And I saw there were two young boys there, maybe in their early teens or 10 or 12 or something. And they didn't quite know what to do, although they were part of the group. So, you know, they were a little sort of nervous. But then they looked at each other and they sort of went like that. And then they also... Because they think that's what you do. If you're a devotee, that's what you do. So anyway, to set a suitable example is very important. Even if you're a liberated soul and you've got no need to follow like a strictly regimented program, or even if you don't need it at all, but to set an example, it's very important. And actually, if you don't set that example, but if you just sort of carry on in your own way, then it's kind of irresponsible, actually. So then Krishna goes on, starting with verse 22, to say that this principle of liberated souls, highly elevated souls, setting a good example is so important that even he does it. Now in the case of Krishna, he obviously has no duty to perform in terms of his material body, because he doesn't have a material body. You know, a liberated soul, he will have a material body and he will have come from some background, according to Varna and Ashram. But in the case of, so, you know, he may then carry on even in his liberated position, acting in terms of that Varna and Ashram, even though he's beyond it. But in the case of Krishna, there's no question of Varna, Ashram, material body, duty, particular type of psychology. There's no question of it. But still he does, because this principle is so important. Of course, Krishna, you know, in many cases, if you look at his pastimes, you'll see he acts nicely, sets a nice example. But there are also times when Krishna just acts independently. It's not that Krishna is forced to act according to the, like, Varnashram codes all the time. So therefore Krishna sometimes, he has his rasa dance and he does this and that. Things which are not according to the codes of Varnashram. But otherwise, you'll see there's so many examples of Krishna performing duties very nicely to set a good example. 23 says that if he didn't do that, then people would be misled, they would follow the example that he set. 24 is quite interesting. Krishna's saying, telling Arjuna that if I didn't perform my duties and set a good example, then other people wouldn't perform their duties. And the result, one of the results of having all these other people not perform their duties, would be unwanted population. They would deviate from the proper codes of moral behavior, and you'd get unwanted population. So you remember that in the first chapter, Arjuna said that if I perform my duty and fight, then the result of my performing my duty will be unwanted population. so therefore I don't want to do my duty.